Welcome to the RFD, a podcast about public forum debate, where we talk about arguments, skills, and strategies that can help inform anyone involved with PF debate at any level. Our goal is to give you useful advice and education, whether you're a novice, varsity, coach, or judge. I'm one of your hosts, Corey Ackerman, Director of Debate at Fairmont Prep in Anaheim, California. And with me is...
Matthew Malia, debate coach at Poly Prep in Brooklyn, New York.
And for those of you who listened to episode 2, as we predicted, the South Korea topic resolved. Deployment of anti-missile systems is in South Korea's best interests, won. The South Korea topic handily won the vote. A total of 243 schools and 853 students voted for the resolution. The winning resolution received 79% of the school vote and 75% of the student vote, which is eerily similar to the Reddit straw poll.
Interesting.
Lucky for some of you listening, your camp probably chose the right topic. Unluckily for all of us, Kim Jong-un is an unstable madman, so a lot of what you cut at camp is obsolete.
Well, hopefully we can help you out then, I guess. Today, we are planning to do a deeper dive into the resolution that won. So we're going to start with some current events in South Korea, North Korea, the other various actors that are now getting involved in the situation. We really want to explore how new current events are going to impact the topic debate. And then following that, we have a preview of a few of the major arguments that you can expect on both sides of the debate over missile defense. We talked about this idea in the previous podcast. The thing in particular we wanted to focus on was the fact that the resolutional wording doesn't mandate that the debate is over South Korea-based anti-missile systems exclusively. So as a result, we want to give you a good overview of what the anti-missile system good-bad debate looks like in general.
Yeah, and that's going to be super interesting because missile defense is one of those things that debaters can debate about forever. But first, a huge shout out to Team USA Debate, who absolutely crushed it in Bali. They put in their best performance since 1999 by making it to the semifinals and placing third overall in the world. For those of you who know her, Public Forum's own Ellie Grossman, who finaled at TOC, was on Team USA. Huge congrats to Sarah, Ellie, Colette, Ella, and Aditya, as well as to the Team USA staff, Aaron Timmons, Cindy Timmons, Sandy Berkowitz, Shane Stafford, and Finelli Mashwama.
Yeah, that is absolutely awesome information. For people who don't know about Team USA Debate and the world debate format, you definitely got to get on Facebook, just get on Google, learn what's going on, because this is absolutely cool. It's basically like the Olympics of debate. It's a debate format that a whole bunch of other nations train in, and we have amazing students in the U.S. who had a great performance. So that's an awesome thing. Congratulations to all those folks involved. Anything else you want to add for the shoutouts, Corey, before we kind of jump into the current events?
No, I don't think anything else is really up there. I mean, there were some kind of minor camps after, you know, the big ones that we talked about in the past couple weeks, but I think it's really time we get to current events because time is short and there's a lot to cover.
The thing that we have to start with first and that most people probably have gotten some news over is the fact that just a few weeks ago, July 28th, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea tested a brand new ICBM that the U.S. military estimated could hit some cities as close as Chicago. So this is a big deal because previously Kim's missile technology wasn't sophisticated enough to reach the continental United States. This is definitely changing the debate a lot.
No, it absolutely is, Matt. You're correct 100%. And a part of the reason is, and you're not hallucinating, there was in fact a different launch on July 4th. Right. What makes the July 28th launch more interesting is because it's a missile that could potentially reach Chicago. They're debating about it, but it also shows that Kim's goal overall is not to strike South Korea or Japan. It's to strike the mainland United States. And the compressed timeline between the July 4th launch and the July 28th launch is kind of frightening.
Mm-hmm. Interesting you point that out. Specifically, the Wall Street Journal had a report that Kim has stated that he would only use nuclear weapons against the United States. So he's trying to assure the region that he's not interested in using his nuclear capabilities against other nations there, but it might not necessarily be so reassuring to people who are actual neighbors with the North Korean regime. Despite the fact that there has been like this new Kim missile threat, there's definitely a little bit of a debate to be had here over whether or not this proves North Korea is or is not a threat. The information that we're citing is information from the Defense Intelligence Agency. There are other intelligence agencies that have weighed in, may weigh in the future. So there's one major intelligence report that is saying that North Korea has this capability. We're going to see what kind of information emerges over the next few weeks about whether or not there's a lot of corroboration of that report, which is going to affect the debate in the actual round about whether or not North Korea is a threat.
And I think Matt would agree with me here that one of the important takeaways is to not allow your opponent to spin this as though this is the end result of North Korean missile tech. They're not going to develop it any further. And that because they're not currently a threat, potentially, depending on the reports that come out in the interim between now and when we debate the topic, that doesn't mean they won't become a threat. Right, just because they are not a threat mm-hmm. now doesn't mean they're not going to stop developing. And I think that the compressed timeline between July 4th, when he gave us an Independence Day gift of a ICBM, and July 28th, when he did it again, shows that there's, you know, very quick development cycle behind these missiles. It's a very high priority for North Korea.
It seems like the North Korean regime may finally be in a place where every test is giving them so much feedback that they're able to really make big advancements and develop the range of these missiles now. There's a lot of other questions surrounding these missiles. Are they able to carry nuclear payloads as far as they're able to fly without the payload? That makes a big difference because that's the weight of the missile, which has an effect on how far you can shoot it reliably, etc. But this is something that you definitely have to get informed on if you're going to be able to make sure that your opponent doesn't tell a story that spins it away from you winning the debate.
Yes, and especially since as recently as, 2 days ago, it came out that North Korea may have developed a miniaturized nuclear weapon capable of fitting on the currently existing ICBMs that they've got, which makes them even more dangerous. And the fact that Kim has said, I mean, as the Wall Street Journal reported, like Matt said, that he specifically says he would only basically first strike the United States and no one else, that's a very telling assessment because mm-hmm. it shows where Kim's sort of threat construction, or rather his view of the world is. And it's not that his neighbors are a threat, or Japan, or anybody else in East or Southeast Asia. It's the United States. Like, this is the main, we are the main target. We are the main thing he wants to deter. And there's quite a bit of history there in terms of how the United States has acted since the turn of the century, from about 2000 till now, regarding things like the Axis of Evil and lessons that Kim may have pulled from Libya. Matt, do you want to talk to us a little bit about that?
Sure. So the story of Libya is as follows. Libya is a country in North Africa, and since 1969, Libya had been under the rule of a famously eccentric military dictator named Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. And Gaddafi had a very complicated relationship with the European nations as well as the United States, and that's for a lot of different reasons that are outside the scope of this podcast. But what you need to know is that Libya was being sanctioned heavily by the Western powers during the 1990s because it became known that Gaddafi had his own nuclear weapon development program. So in 2003, when the United States invaded Iraq, partially based on the false premise that Iraq had been illegally possessing and developing WMD, this was a big deal to Gaddafi, and it really scared him. He did not want the same thing that happened to Iraq to happen to Libya. So Gaddafi made the surprisingly proactive step of voluntarily dismantling his own nuclear weapon development program and demonstrating to the United States and Europe that he no longer had nuclear ambitions. And this was considered a big win at the time for the Bush administration, and it was pretty big for Gaddafi too, because it did allow him to last a little bit longer than he might have otherwise. However, Gaddafi's rule did come to an end. In 2011, the Arab Spring came knocking, and by the time it reached Libya, it had already knocked off Tunisia as well as Egypt. And it's likely that Gaddafi may have survived the uprisings, if not for the fact that the NATO countries intervened militarily on behalf of the Arab Spring rebels by using air power to demobilize Gaddafi's military. And this prevented Gaddafi from defending himself as well as crushing the rebel strongholds, which meant that his government fell. And Gaddafi was famously murdered in the streets in a brutal fashion by his people. So the moral of the story is, even if you voluntarily give up your own nuclear weapon program, that still does not prevent you from being bullied by the Western powers.
Yeah. And the big part about this is this gets back to some things that might have happened before, well, right around when some of you were born, which is the so-called Axis of Evil, which President George Bush named in a State of the Union address, which was Iran, Iraq, and North Korea. And in addition, Libya was not a part of it, but I think that it's important for us to realize that Kim took certain lessons from U.S. foreign policy, because what we do does not exist in a vacuum, right? He saw that how we treated Saddam Hussein, he saw how we treated Muammar Gaddafi, both of those dictators disarmed their weapons of mass destruction, although there's some debate about Iraq, but he looks at Iran, and he sees that Iran is developing a robust nuclear weapons program, and hey, look at that, they go uninvaded by the West. So for Kim, nuclear weapons are sort of a thing that he probably will never give up, because they are a shield to prevent his country from being invaded by what he sees as imperialist warmongers. And I'm doing air quotes around that.
Gaddafi was killed violently by the revolution that deposed him. And Saddam Hussein was killed after a trial led by the United States, I believe. Kim does not want that to happen to him. Like, he does not want to be executed by the United States. He does not want to be murdered by North Korean exiles who come back to lead some sort of revolution. For him, it's pretty important that he has nuclear weapons as a bulwark against Western intervention that could put him personally in danger, could put his family in danger, and basically collapse the three-generation dynasty that has led North Korea now.
Yeah, I mean, you gotta remember that these weapons, like what Matt said is 100% correct. What these weapons are for is not necessarily external threats, but also internal ones, right? Mm-hmm. If some rebel group managed to get hold of a minor city outside of Pyongyang and use it as a base of operations, he can hold a nuclear weapon over them like a sword of Damocles to get them to surrender because they would not be able to retaliate in a similar fashion.
And that's a pretty huge game changer because you look at a place like Syria where we've all heard of the barrel bombing and the use of chemical weapons, which is horrific. It's still an entirely different scale of destruction than what a nuclear explosion is able to make possible on a battlefield. So this is a part of the debate that really gets to the heart of what Kim's motivations are. And that's something that people are probably going to want to be able to speak elegantly on in order to control the conversation that happens over whether or not Kim is a madman. Can Kim be deterred? Why is he doing what he's doing, etc.?
Yep. And so getting back to current events, the fact that this launch happened on July 28th, it kind of made things go crazy, right? Especially if you had gone to camp before this, right? Suddenly South Korea is deploying THAAD went from, well, when we get around to it, we have to do an environmental impact study. It went to like, we have to deploy it right now, right? Additionally, South Korea has requested the ability to develop better missiles and better payload capability. And some of the South Korean opposition party have also asked for tactical nuclear weapons to be deployed to South Korea, which is a huge change in policy, right?
Mm-hmm.
The leader of the opposition party, Hong Joon-pyo, is quoted as saying, "Peace will come when we achieve a balance of power, not when we are begging for it." For those of you who have studied European history, you will notice that a balance of power was what led to World War I. So these things are not necessarily, these are very loaded language that historically has led to the deaths of millions. We have to be super careful with it. And in addition, Japan is also looking to increase its own armaments. They include long-range cruise missiles, air-ground missiles, and refueling aircraft to extend the range of fighter jets. And again, for those of you who study a little bit of history, you know that Japan rearming sort of makes everybody in East Asia quake because of what happened in World War II. So this is a situation that's quickly spiraling out of control.
This is a huge entry into the conversation on this debate topic about the potential for South Korea and Japan to build up their arms, increase the risk of sort of miscalculation in the area because there'll be more potential bullets ready to fly. And later on down the road, there could be the potential for South Korea or Japan and South Korea to have nuclear arsenals in order to specifically deter the North Korean regime. And that really complicates the situation enormously. I guess we're going to have to talk a little bit more about what multipolar deterrence looks like and why it's a little bit more complex when we get finished with our current events overview. The other thing that we have to talk about, obviously, is the American response to all these things that are happening. The comic show that we see from the Trump administration is basically three different people all working against each other, telling different stories. One part is saber-rattling at North Korea, which Trump does via tweets and his declarations. That fury and fire are what the North Korean regime is going to see coming if they aren't less provocative. And then he also has some of his other leaders, like Secretary of State Tillerson, as well as Secretary of Defense, making statements about how everything is calm and there's no need to be worried and we're not about to have a war with North Korea. And people are a little bit confused who they should really be taking the lead from. I imagine that Kim is probably preparing for the worst just because the other people say that Trump is just playing, is not really serious about it. Doesn't necessarily mean that Kim can be confident that Trump is not serious about it. Additionally, besides the United States not really having a clear story about what they actually want to do to respond to North Korea, there was a pretty big sanctions bill that went through the United Nations in order to put a lot of pressure on North Korea. This was the United Nations where the sanction resolution occurred. Is that true, Corey?
Yep. And it was 15-0, which is tremendous because that means that all five members of the Security Council, any one of which could have vetoed it, including China and Russia, all voted for this really extremely strong sanctions package against North Korea.
So in a lot of ways, that's a pretty big diplomatic win for pressure on North Korea. It's hard to really say who the credit for the victory should go for. It's unimaginable to most of us that Trump is really leading the way in terms of getting the world to kind of be diplomatically banded against North Korea. Maybe behind the scenes, some of these other members of the administration are doing a little bit to help get other nations on our, you know, on the same agenda in order to pressure North Korea. The other reason that this is a big deal, not to get into too much, not to get too distracted from the topic, but the Iran sanctions are a pretty important model for how other nations could pressure North Korea to disarm or to slow their nuclear weapon capability advancement process. One of the major accomplishments of the Obama administration was getting so many nations onto the same page in terms of sanctioning Iran to actually bring unified pressure to bear, forcing them to come to the table for the nuclear deal that now is also something that the Trump administration has put into flux.
Yeah, and the reason why this matters is because a lot of our anti-sanctions evidence, especially from the back files you might see, deals with sanctions as they were, sort of like the Iraq sanctions, as opposed to the new mode of sanctions that is deployed, like against Russia, where it's targeted against individuals or even individual banks. And what we're targeting in North Korea's case, their economic lifeline, oil, coal, steel exports, especially to China. And there's a fair amount of analysis about whether or not China is actually going to enforce the sanctions. But for the moment, they've signed on.
Mm-hmm. You can do a little bit of research just by Googling the term smart sanctions.
Yeah. And if their authors don't engage specifically with these new modern sanctions that are being deployed, you should absolutely, you know, bloody their lip on it, because it's not good for them to be reading evidence that does not talk about modern Russia, Iran, North Korea sanctions.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely true.
The other thing we want to call attention to is that you should remember that the first pod's analysis still holds true. That's episode 2. The Kim regime has a history of making bellicose threats that it cannot or does not make good on. This may well be one of those cases. North Korea really likes attention. It especially likes attention from the West because we're rich and we can give them the money they need to perpetuate the regime. It likes people thinking it's powerful. Even while it's those squashing the country would be painful for us as well as South Korea. I mean, keep in mind, 250,000 American expats live in South Korea along with 28,000, you know, a 28,000 strong army base. The United States could do it between our conventional weapons and our total domination of the sky. We could beat North Korea. It would just entail a lot of pain. Especially if China seals the border and just leaves North Korea to fend for itself, which, given recent Chinese troop movements, seems to be the play. They just don't want to be overrun with North Korean refugees. In the notes for this cast, there's going to be a link to an article in the Washington Post about Kim. Reporter Anna Feifeld is doing great reporting here, and she's a pro follow on Twitter about this issue.
Mm-hmm. What this means for the debate, you can find lots of analysis that says that the United States could stop Kim, could squash North Korea. There's just as much analysis that says that it would be a disaster to try to do so because of the amount, you know, the bloody nose that we would get in return, basically. Like, the North Koreans are dug in. They've been preparing to defend themselves from a Western U.S.-led invasion for a very long time now, and it would be a very difficult thing to do. So the impact evidence that you're able to kind of discover on this debate about what a war with North Korea looks like has all sorts of scary scenarios within it. You definitely need to take a look at what people are saying in that area.
Yeah, and you also have to remember that some people have, when you read the evidence, keep in mind what the author's agenda is. Some people want to make a war with North Korea seem very devastating, but given North Korea's sort of shadowy nature and the lack of Western knowledge about it, it's extremely difficult to know just how capable North Korea is short of actually going to war with them. Like, they say they have an army 1 million men strong and 5 million in reserve, and they say they're ready to fight to the death, but it's really hard to say if any of that is actually true. I mean, their artillery is 30 miles from Seoul, but do they have the shells required for actual sustained operations, right? These things don't come out of thin air.
Right. The material, the actual ability to put their forces into play, those are all big question marks, but you kind of have to plan for the worst in those sorts of scenarios. Like, we see the disaster of the American invasion of Iraq as an example of what happens when you don't plan for the worst. So hopefully people who are wargaming out these scenarios are going to decide whether or not we actually do end up in some sort of shooting conflict with the North Korean regime, are really doing their best to analyze these things and figure out what the true risks are so that an informed decision can be made.
And the reason when we talk about Kim, and for those of you who debated the Cuba topic, you might recall that some of those debates came down to who could better explain to the judge Raul Castro and Miguel Diaz-Canales' mindsets, motivations, and internal logic.
Yeah.
In our opinion, we think this topic is probably going to come down to something similar, at least the Kim-centered parts of it. Like, there will be parts of it that aren't Kim-centered, but if you can sell the judge a convincing narrative of who Kim is, why he does the things he does, and the best way to stop him, I think you're in a good position to win the debate. Especially, you know, is he a bully who reacts to being stood up to, or do we just need to pat him on the head and tell him to go away? It's escalation versus diplomatic pressure, and that's the real question about at the core of the Kim debate and your ability to control it.
When you say pat him on the head and go away, can you be a little bit more specific there? What choices do we have besides kind of bully him back?
I mean, we could pay him to go away. That seems to be South Korea's general strategy for his father. Like, the belief among that I, you know, from South Koreans I've spoken to, when you read South Korean papers, it's that when they do artillery strikes at the ocean or when they act really, really aggressive, all they want is some money to be paid to go away. They just are broke and they need money, and that's all we have to do. We just have to pay them to go away. And sort of the American administration short circuits this because Trump is, unfortunately, at least in public, taking Kim's threats very seriously, even though it would be very difficult for Kim to actually deliver on almost all of them. And by doing
right. I mean,
that,
we know,
you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was about to say that we know from the campaign trail that Trump is somebody who tends to get drawn into the war of words, or I guess the pissing match. And so Kim is the perfect adversary for Trump because Kim also seems to love attention, and he's had a lot of time practicing pushing the line just far enough to get the desired response, and Trump is just getting his buttons pushed, and the man doesn't really understand how to stop feeding the troll.
Yeah, and this is sort of a perfect storm for the United States, because in the United States, we tend to run a little paranoid, as some of you out there might have noticed that. And it's just a little bit, you know, the paranoid style in American politics. And so when Kim says, oh my God, I'm going to totally destroy you, some people take him very seriously, even though his ability as an existential threat to the United States is almost nil. Like, I'm not saying that a war with Kim wouldn't be bad. And if he destroyed LA, I'd be very sad. If he destroyed Honolulu or Anchorage, it would be a disaster. But his ability to actually topple our government or defeat us is nil.
That would be devastating. I have friends in all three of those cities. I'm sure some of the listeners might be from those cities. But the other thing is that the idea of like accepting limited nuclear war is something that was really spoken about a lot in the 1970s and 80s when people were seriously considering the United States and Soviet Union having a potential nuclear exchange and what it would mean. And it's a really terrifying possibility. The actual obliteration of an entire city, all those lives lost, all of the collateral damage, all of the people in like the blast ranges that get severely burned, have their skin seared, etc. This is the type of event that would change the history of civilization in a way that we can't even begin to understand. So there's like a pretty big imperative to really reduce the risk of this happening. And the more and more so-called rogue actors like the North Korean regime get their hands on the capability to do this, the more and more we really do have to kind of take it at face value and make sure that it's not a possibility that we let happen.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. I mean, our entire deterrence infrastructure is not built to handle a threat like North Korea. It doesn't work. It starts to fall apart. Like, it works against Russia. It works against China. Obviously, we're all still here, because if this is the afterlife, it's extremely disappointing. But, you know, the ability for him to wipe out a single city, I mean, yes, that makes missile defense super important, but there's also no indication that missile defense will work 100% of the time.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, to get back to where the current events ties in here, one of the things that has happened that you kind of briefly touched on at the beginning of the cast was the fact that the South Korean government has decided to rapidly deploy THAAD. That's to respond to North Korea's actions. And the problem that cons may run into as a result of this new change is that the pro team may kind of stand up and say, well, South Korea thinks that they really need these things and we should listen to them and we should believe as a result that anti-missile defenses are good or are in South Korea's best interests, I should say. But you have to remember that just because the South Koreans have shown they want something doesn't necessarily mean that it's in their best interest. Being able to prove that it's more of a political as opposed to a strategic benefit might be what you need to be able to push back on there. Some people listening probably want to drink soda with every meal, or you might hate eating vegetables. That doesn't mean it's a good idea. Everybody can recognize the difference between desires and best interests. And that's something that you're going to have to make sure the pro team doesn't bludgeon you with.
Absolutely. Especially when you're talking about Moon, right? Like we talked about in the last cast, Moon has basically been for unification his entire political career. I mean, I don't think it's a stretch to say he's a bit of a dove. And I think that he's sort of overcorrecting in a lot of ways. He's going, well, you know, I didn't treat the threat from North Korea very seriously. Now all of a sudden I have to treat it super seriously. And in the space of 2 days, he went from, we're going to deploy THAAD maybe in 9 months to, we're going to deploy THAAD tomorrow. That's a massive course correction.
There is a backstory too, potentially there, that says that South Korea is actually very fearful of the potential for a North Korean-U.S. nuclear standoff to escalate. And as a result, South Korea is interested in making the moves that make the U.S. feel confident, reduce the feeling of threat that the Trump administration is currently facing so that we don't risk having Trump push the button.
Absolutely. And so when you talk about best interests, right, we have to think of the long term. And that might be how you end up framing the debate as you move into the summaries and the final focuses, right? Short term versus long term. That Moon is looking at super short term solutions to this problem. And those just may end up escalating because what's going to happen when North Korea, when THAAD is fully deployed? What's North Korea going
to
do?
In addition to the debate about whether or not North Korea will respond to THAAD in an aggressive way, or maybe it will kind of cause North Korea to change their approach in some more positive way, there's also a general growing recognition that we may have to just deal with the fact that North Korea is a dangerous nuclear power. Like, North Korea is dug in, North Korea is dangerous. The United States can't really credibly threaten military action because all of the allies are against it due to the extraordinary damage it would cause to the region. And the United States military is not exactly happy to go in there and do that. They're not jonesing for a fight with the North Koreans right now, despite Trump's overtures. So overall, it may mean that the next phase of this conflict On the Korean Peninsula is one where the United States and Japan and South Korea and others accept that North Korea is a full-fledged nuclear power, and they now have to move into the next setting, which is figuring out what their plan to deter and defend themselves in relationship to North Korea is. And that could be part of the debate where THAAD really makes an impact, because that might be the difference between South Korea developing their own nuclear capabilities to have some sort of bilateral mutually assured destruction with Kim, or it may not. That may not have a big impact there, but that's certainly something that's up for debate.
Yeah, and I think that it screws the pro a little bit here, because if Kim was going to come to the table, now would be the time, essentially. Mm-hmm. Right? The sanctions have been deployed. THAAD is about to be fully deployed. Japan and South Korea are both talking about rearming. If THAAD was going to force him to negotiate away his nuclear weapons, it would be happening now. So unless it happens between now and Kentucky, I think the truth is not going to be on the pro side, at least on that portion of the debate. That doesn't mean that you can't use THAAD to protect against the potential impacts of a nuclear North Korea. I just don't think you're going to be able to credibly claim solvency on North Korean nuclear weapons.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. I don't think that it's going to be very easy to frequently prove that THAAD forces Kim to the table. You might be able to show that despite THAAD not being uniquely capable, the confluence of issues is going to bring Kim to the table eventually. But, you know, Kim is stronger now than he's ever been. He has a missile that goes further than ever before. The West believes he might be able to put a nuclear weapon on the end of it, which, even if it's not true that he can do that, it forces us to act as if he might be able to, which changes what the United States can do. And he has an economy that's doing better than ever before under his reign. Now is the time for him to sort of take more ground, if possible. If he wanted to negotiate, he might be able to negotiate from a position of relative strength, but his refusal to come to the table and to be interested in a deal, at least so far, may indicate that Kim actually truly believes that he's only going to grow more powerful in the short term, meaning that he doesn't want to give up that trajectory.
And we didn't even talk about the fact that the American administration can't decide on a strategy. Like, leaving aside partisan feelings about Trump, the inability for America to come up with a single strategy to deal with this gives a lot of mixed signals not only to the world, which makes us seem fundamentally unserious, but to Kim as well, because it's just like, oh, they have no clue what they're going to do to me. I can just do whatever I want, because they all respond in 8 different ways and none of them will actually be followed through on.
And another tidbit that complicates that even more is that Trump administration can't seem to figure out what they're going to do to follow up on the Iran deal. And because the Iran deal that the Obama administration put into place could be a model to address the North Korea nuclearization issue, how the Trump administration reacts to Iran could also affect what Kim is willing to agree to in the future. If it turns out that the Trump administration doesn't want to honor that deal, then what credibility does the United States have to deal with Kim? Kim is not going to trust anything that the Trump administration is willing to bring to the table. So we're on a potential collision course.
Yeah. Essentially, as long as Kim and Trump keep spitting rivets at each other, this topic is just going to keep getting bigger and bigger and encompass more and more things. It's going to get harder and harder, mm-hmm. and you're going to have less and less control over where the debate goes. So having a clear strategy in mind before the round even starts will probably serve you better on this topic than it would on most others, simply because you just don't know what the other side is going to say, like where they're going to take the debate.
Absolutely. They could take any of these new details and tell a story about those details in particular. So you do need to spend some time figuring out what your story is going to be so that you control narrative and don't let them mix up what's happening by introducing their own set of facts.
All right, Matt, what do you think? It's time for a contention rundown?
First and foremost, we've already discussed whether or not North Korea is or is not serious, right? So on one side of the debate, the con, you definitely want to be emphasizing that North Korea is not actually serious and that treating the North Korean threat as a serious threat only really legitimizes Kim and drives him toward further and further provocations. We need a different way to respond to these, more of the pat him on the head and tell him to go away type stuff that you talked about before.
Yeah, and the other way to look at this is that North Korea is actually super serious. The fact that they launched that second ICBM July 28th shows it. Let's be real, between now and Kentucky, there might be another ICBM launch, or now and whenever your first tournament is. He's probably launched another one. Yeah, there could be multiple ones, right? He seems to be doing one every 3 weeks lately. And so that, you know, is going to make it seem like he's very serious. And so I think you're going to be able to paint a very convincing portrait for the judge of a North Korea that is attempting to box the United States in with its aggression.
Mm-hmm. Now, given that the North Korean regime's threat could breach the United States now, there's the next contention conversation, which is about whether or not the United States missile shield itself could provide the United States the security necessary to, you know, deal with North Korea in an effective way. We might argue that we make the United States safer with anti-missile systems, and as a result, it's less likely that Trump will have to feel worried enough to go and bring the military option to bear against North Korea. Alternatively, the argument that anti-missile systems aren't going to prevent Kim from being able to strike at the U.S. homeland, that's an argument that the other side of the debate may need to take up.
Yeah, and there's also the fact that he could just develop a better missile, which is the usual response to AMDs. And I think that if you've done any research into it, India and Pakistan have sort of been on the road to proving that. India has begun developing AMDs, and Pakistan's response was, okay, we're just going to build more missiles.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of contentions, any thought on South Korean politics? Is there an argument to be made there about what's going on and how it might relate to best interests?
I think that there is a very convincing argument, at least in my opinion, on the con, which is that South Korean politics is overcorrecting for the perceived softness or weakness of Moon on North Korea. And you can see it sort of in the rhetoric of the opposition leader. I mean, calling for the deployment of tactical nuclear weapons, like U.S. tactical nuclear weapons in South Korea, is insane.
Yeah,
right?
That's a huge deal. It's a huge deal. It makes you look like a lackey of the United States in some ways. Which is
not only that, it's hugely provoking. It's hugely provoking of Kim. Look, you have nuclear weapons. We're going to put nuclear weapons right next to you. How about that?
Right, yeah. But, I mean, according to some people, that's the only way to actually truly have peace.
Yeah, and that's the if that's the case, then South Korea is protected by the U.S. nuclear umbrella, which can already strike Kim. The only reason to put nuclear weapons in his backyard is some sort of, you know, measuring contest between the two. Just be like, you've got nukes, well, we've got nukes too. And that's an insane way to do foreign policy.
Well, but there is the follow-on question there, which is that, you know, the United States nuclear umbrella is a theory. It's hopefully a true theory, but it may not be true in practice, and the South Koreans may need to worry about whether or not the United States is going to be willing to go to the mat for them if Kim can actually give the United States a true nuclear black eye now, which he might not have been able to do before. So that's kind of a reason that U.S. missile defense has a pretty significant impact. It might mean that the United States is willing to continue to stand up to North Korea on South Korea's behalf, despite the fact that North Korea might be able to detonate Chicago or Los Angeles. South Korea has to worry as a result of North Korea having those capabilities in a way they didn't have to worry before.
And I can sort of totally, just to add another wrinkle into this, I can sort of totally see why South Korea want their own tactical nuclear weapons, and it's because of what happened to Ukraine, right? The Ukraine gave up their nuclear weapons in exchange for a security agreement with the United States, mm-hmm. and now they're mired in a civil war with the Russians, like proxy battle.
And they're wondering,
where's the United States' promise to help their territorial integrity? Well, it turned out that Obama wasn't willing to end the world over the Ukraine.
Exactly.
And North Korea might be looking into a similar situation. Like, who's ready to create Armageddon over one nation in one part of the world, right? Our view is much larger than that.
Right.
So South Korea having their own tactical nuclear weapons in that scenario makes it makes sense. But that's just another geopolitical wrinkle that makes this topic, like already huge topic, even more complicated.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. In terms of contentions, we talk about the sanctions resolution that passed. Is that an advantage for the pro or the con? Who's going to get more mileage out talking about that issue?
I think the con is, especially if they're able to convincingly argue that THAAD is a provocation rather than a defensive stance. Right, that you got to give the sanctions time to work. All THAAD does is make Kim seem like he's boxed in and he's just going to keep developing missiles and do that and act aggressively instead of approaching the West and trying to work through this problem. Right, THAAD means he must develop better missiles because otherwise he cannot defend himself. And that if you're able, that and that's where it gets more complicated because you have to be able to convince the judge that Kim's actions are defensive, not offensive.
It's a little bit counterintuitive to say that having a missile that can strike some other continent is a purely defensive measure. However, in the theory of deterrence, it potentially is the best defense.
Yes. And again, this gets back to the axis of evil and Libya thing. Kim knows how the United States treats nations without weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah, absolutely. And what you just described is the arms race contention, basically, something that's probably going to be a big part of the debate. The conversation about whether or not anti-missile systems ratchet up or ratchet down North Korea's drive to have bigger and more dangerous weapons.
And this is one where I think the pro just gets hosed again, because a part of THAAD was deployed, you know, months ago, and Kim's response was to develop better missiles. Well, I just don't see how more THAAD changes that equation.
Yeah, I mean, being able to link THAAD deployment to Kim's missile desires might be the complication there. Kim probably wants to have the long-range capability, even if the United States doesn't have a more sophisticated anti-missile system in South Korea.
Absolutely, but that gets us back to sanctions, right? Things like sanctions, things like diplomacy, they take time. If we deploy THAAD and create an arms race, that compresses his timeline for action. All of a sudden, he needs to develop his missiles tomorrow, not 6 months from now. And so we don't have the time necessary for these diplomatic options to take hold.
Yep, and for people who aren't really sure whether or not this time issue is a significant one, it was a huge milestone when the United States successfully pushed Iran's development timeline off by just 6 months to 1 year. Getting an extra 1 year between today and capabilities ready to launch, is an enormous diplomatic victory because it means that you have just so much more runway to work with.
And so much more time for the pressure to build, because the sanctions are targeting and affecting their growing industry. They need these raw materials. They need to sell these things to China. And every day that they aren't hurts their economy and destabilizes the regime that much more, or rather puts pressure on them that much more.
And a crucial question of the debate there in the sanctions contention area will be whether or not China is going to stand by the resolution. To vote for the resolution is one thing, but to actually enforce the restrictions at the border is another, because China is also interested in economic development, and getting some of those resources does help China deal with the issue of not having enough jobs.
And we had such a lovely little topic up until about a month ago, and then it just started spiraling out of control and hasn't stopped.
Yeah, definitely. There's one more contention area I definitely want to mention, which is the China area. I know that a major argument people have already been making is that South Korea's best interests are harmed by China's economic pressure that they have brought to bear as a response to South Korea's embrace of THAAD. A lot of South Korean businesses that operate in China have been punished by the Chinese government as a form of retaliation to sort of persuade South Korea to not continue with THAAD deployment. And China has a lot of different reasons for being a little bit upset with THAAD, which can be explored and debated. But that's a major argument, that because South Korea is somewhat economically dependent on China, their best interests are most directly harmed by China's lack of desire for THAAD, the fact that they lose their relationship with China, the fact that China can punish them directly.
Yeah, and we talked about this a little bit last cast. With the United States sort of withdrawing into itself and removing itself from TPP, South Korea is going to be looking around going, well, we rely on trade for everything we do. Who's left? I think that the thing that undermines that contention, which, again, I think is pretty good because the story is true, is that North Korea's aggression towards the United States requires the fast-tracking of that. At a certain point, the United States is still a very large trading partner of South Korea's, and our security is crucial as well.
Yeah. The actual conversation about the Trans-Pacific Partnership is an interesting one, but it is something that people should take note of. There's a specific free trade agreement between the United States and South Korea. So while the issue of some of the American allies in Asia being in a security relationship with the United States, but having much more of an economic relationship with China is a big one that divides the region, in South Korea's case, there is a free trade agreement which gives South Korea a little bit more stickiness to the alliance it has with the United States. We have that economic glue as opposed to just that security glue.
Yeah, but it's also about signaling, right? Sometimes what you do is as important as how you do it, or rather how it looks when you do it. And so removing TPP, withdrawing from TPP, even if we have a free trade agreement specifically with South Korea, makes the United States look insular. And when you're the leader of the free world, how you look matters a lot.
It does. And there's the credibility issue in general. If the United States wasn't able to convince South Korean government to move forward with THAAD due to the fact that North Korea had been launching these missiles, then it would mean that the United States doesn't actually have the ability to bring much, you know, pressure to bear on its allies even. So the fact that South Korea is moving forward is important because it shows that the United States can get stuff done in the region still.
Yeah, or the alternative interpretation is that we had zero political capital with South Korea and it was basically a disastrous emergency that, you know, forced them to fast track THAAD.
That could be the case, but we would hope that it's a little bit more planned than that.
Yeah, we would hope, but then again,
hope for the best, fear potentially the worst. I mean, the worst here, I think, is basically the other part of what all these contentions get to, which is, are Trump and Kim going to actually come to blows? I mean, we have two people who aren't predictable overall. There's a debate to be had over whether or not either of them is a rational person. There's the debate that realists have, or the position that the realists have, which is that all of these political leaders at the end of the day are going to do what's absolutely necessary to maximize the defense, the security, and the power of their nation. And that means that potentially they're all rational at a base level, but we don't really know what these two people are going to be doing.
Yep, absolutely. It's terrifying. But let's move on to missile defense, because that seems to be what we've been hinting at all podcasts.
Yeah, and this is the part that
it's going to be a huge part of the debate.
I'm most excited for this. I think the missile defense debate is very interesting, so I really hope that people have to debate.
You would.
I mean, it's high tech. It's contemporary. It connects to history. It's a way that history and current events connect, because there's a very clear continuity between, you know, the United States and Soviet Union's face-off and the current things that we're doing today. So I hope that people who have to judge and debate this part of the topic again and again, you know, can find some of the interest in it that I find.
Yeah, and you know my opinion on this, which is the reason why the debate is a little silly, is because it's completely unresolvable. There's no way to actually convince some. I mean, you maybe can convince someone, but at the end of the day, you could argue this debate in circles forever.
Yes, many of the arguments just bite the tail of the next argument and vice versa.
All right, so how about we start with missile defense good? Let's just roll right into it.
Yeah, go for it. What do you think the best missile defense good argument is?
The best missile defense argument is that nuclear weapons are bad and that we should shoot them down before they hit what they're going to hit.
The bottom line here is the probability of a nuclear launch is not zero.
Yeah, I mean, there's just so many ways a nuclear weapon can go off. Miscalculation, just straight out a crazy person. I mean, for the longest time, most of the United States' nuclear weapon codes were like 80s because we wanted to be able to launch them immediately. So, you know, you've got the madman problem. I mean, the Soviet Union almost launched a nuclear war because of, like, a nuclear submarine that misread a radar guide. It was one dude who stopped a nuclear war between the United States and Russia. This is not impossible, right? You've got the madman theory, accidental launch, actual need to first strike because you think that they're going to first strike you first, you know?
One of the things that H.R. McMaster said recently, like this past Sunday, was that conventional deterrence theory doesn't really apply to Kim because he's already willing to commit so much violence against the people of North Korea that he would probably be willing to lose a few hundred thousand of them in a nuclear explosion if it accomplishes objectives. And that's H.R. McMaster. Now,
the national security advisor.
Yes. Now, admittedly, on I believe it was the very same show, Mike Pompeo, the CIA director, I believe, said that deterrence does absolutely work against North Korea. So there's a little bit of a mixed message there as well. But fundamentally, a scenario where somebody might use a nuclear weapon could be anything from an accident to kind of like a suicidal madman type scenario. Posit the hypothetical of what do you think Hitler would have done if he had a nuclear capability and the forces were descending on his Berlin bunker? Would he not have used it, knowing that he was going to die? There's all sorts of evil people out there who might be able to put their finger near the button. So being able to stop it from happening is a big deal.
Yeah, and we also like the idea that a shield makes it harder to hit. And so that it makes somebody like Kim's blustering threats harder for him to actually execute on, because if he tried, we could just shoot his missile down. Mm-hmm.
Now, there's two more like major missile defense good arguments I think people will come across, and I want to kind of list them off together because I think they work together. And the first one is that missile defense can enhance deterrence because it makes it harder for hostile actors to have the expectation that their moves are going to work. So if you use a defense system to raise the cost of a hostile action, like if you make it harder for Kim to believe that his missile will work, then it reduces his expectation that he can get what he wants with nuclear bullying. And that is part of the story of deterrence. You want to affect people's decision-making thresholds and make them believe that they won't win. And the second half of that is that by raising and lowering thresholds for what's going to work and what's not going to work in the mind of somebody like Kim or any other foreign power, you also prevent other nations from being able to get in the way of what we want to do. So that could be freedom of action, for instance. The United States has a lot of military forces deployed to Korea. A successful missile defense shield would mean that we can use them without having to fear China or North Korea hitting them with missile systems to demobilize them or something like that. As a result, the United States has more flexibility to do what it wants to do in the northeastern portion of Asia. So that's like the freedom of action rationale, that if we have missile defense, we can do more and we can have greater American leadership and hegemony. And South Korea is a big example of that because, technically speaking, we do want that to protect the American troops in South Korea, as well as the South Korean cities that North Korea puts under the gun.
Yeah, and for most of this, we've been talking about what I would argue is conventional, in quotes, because really it's all conventional, missile defense, which is literally trying to hit a bullet with another bullet. There is another kind of missile, anti-missile system that does exist that we have used successfully in the past. And that involves hacking the missiles to prevent them from launching in the first place. Matt, you want to talk to us about that?
You kind of described it perfectly. Basically, the idea here is that cyber espionage that prevents the missiles from being able to be actually used successfully or gets in the way of developing the missiles could be considered an anti-missile system in a lot of ways. I don't know if the resolutional wording is going to define hacking out, but I think there's a pretty good argument to be made that one of the ways the United States has stopped Kim from being able to use his missiles as aggressively as he's used them so far is by attacking his infrastructure, by getting in the way of his tests with cyber raids. You can read about this by Googling for a New York Times article called Obama's Secret Cyber War with North Korea. It gives you great details about...
Yeah, we'll also put that into the notes on the podcast. Yeah,
definitely. It's a must-read article for the topic, even if you don't think that this is an example of missile defense, because you may have to debate a team who does want to make the debate about whether or not cyber raids on the North Korean missile infrastructure are good or bad.
Yeah, especially on this topic, because this topic is going to be so big, people are going to be looking for the squirreliest little arguments they can to try to negate or avoid or judo most of your offense.
And it is an argument that has an impact, too, if you're able to make it part of the conversation and you can avoid the topicality challenge. And the reason is because North Korea is actually a really big cyber aggressor. North Korea has attacked a lot of American companies. Some people believe that North Korea was responsible for the massive ransomware attack that basically halted business as usual in almost half of Europe for an entire workday a few months ago. And that could be in response to the fact that the United States has been hitting their missile tests with cyber espionage pretty persistently for the past few years.
Yep. All right, let's move on to, I think that pretty much covers it. Let's move on to missile defense bad.
Well, we've talked a lot about arms races, right? I mean, missile defense encourages your adversary to build a better missile. Adversaries feel forced to increase either the number of missiles they have to overwhelm the system. We talked about that in the previous podcast. It's a numbers game. If missile defense is 90% successful and you send 100 missiles, then that's 10 cities that are still obliterated by your attack. Countermeasures is another part of this debate. One of the most terrifying examples of a countermeasure imagined is the MIRV. Some of you might have heard of this. God, it's an acronym for Multiple Independently Targetable Reentry Vehicles. And this is a type of...
I still remember the first time I heard them called Christmas tree missiles.
Oh, I mean, they literally are like Christmas tree full of ornaments that just rain down. 10, 20, I think the Peacekeeper carries over 10 nuclear warheads. Is that correct? Like 16 nuclear warheads might be what the Peacekeeper carries.
It's a terrifying amount.
The point here is that it's a nuclear warhead that's able to be put on an intercontinental ballistic missile, go to its destination, but just prior to exploding at its destination, the warhead can split into multiple sub-warheads that all have their own independent trajectories. And the MIRV is basically a countermeasure that was developed by both the United States and the Soviet Union to really put a final nail in the idea, the coffin of the idea that missile defense would help either nation. That's the ultimate example of why countermeasures are a really dangerous dissad to missile defense.
Yeah, because the technology that went into the MIRV is, you know, they're designed to wipe out one missile, 16 cities. I mean, you can only hit so many, and that's if you hit them at all. Like, the other major con to missile defense is that it doesn't always work. Mm-hmm. You're trying to hit a bullet with another bullet, and even in U.S. testing, in ideal conditions, it only works about 80% of the time, and guess what? That number is probably inflated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, they want to make it look like this system is going to work so they can keep getting funding for it, obviously.
Yeah, and because it makes us feel safe, which is dangerous because it also allows us to be more provocative.
That's one of the things that a lot of people fear, and that's one of the reasons that there used to be an agreement not to have missile defense. Nations were afraid that a nuclear-armed nation with a missile defense would basically be able to bully anybody because there's no way to deter them.
Yeah, and that gets us back to the heart of deterrence, which is a very, very simple equation. You die, I die. We can think it's repugnant and it's terrible, but the whole world has functioned on it since the 1950s. And it works best when it's simple. The calculation shouldn't be, you die, I die, maybe you die, because that changes your thinking in terms of whether or not you're going to deploy your nuclear weapons at all, and whether you should use them or lose them, and things like that. It just adds more wrinkles to an already fraught situation.
Right. This gets really complicated because Asia already has multiple nuclear powers. Obviously, there's China, India, Pakistan, as well as the United States all participating. North Korea's nascent capability is now one of the major players in the region as well. So anytime an individual leader of one of these nuclear-armed nations is in a diplomatic confrontation or is basically involved in a nuclear standoff, they have to think not just about the actual bilateral deterrence with their adversary, but about the way that there's all these other actors in the region who may also respond. And that, as a result, creates, through multilateral deterrence, a much more complex balance of nuclear power, meaning there's a lot more steps along the way that could fail. Any one particular leader could make a fatal decision that causes the entire system to shoot off at each other. As a result, we want less and less people to be in a position to make that mistake, because we've had a lot of close calls, as you mentioned. If there were a lot more opportunities for close calls, we can't guarantee that they're all going to be resolved without nuclear death.
Yes, especially since a lot of the nations in East Asia and Southeast Asia and just the Pacific in general could potentially arm themselves with nuclear weapons and don't because the United States has them under our security umbrella. Right. We're talking Australia, we're talking Japan, we're talking South Korea. All of these nations could potentially arm themselves with nuclear weapons, not tomorrow, but very quickly. Yeah, I mean, if North Korea can do it, those countries can do it.
Yeah, they're much more advanced technologically speaking than North Korea. They all have nuclear energy capabilities.
Yeah, if you can build a nuclear reactor, you can build a nuclear bomb. Yep. The principle is very similar.
And even before you add the fact that there could be new entrants into the potential for a nuclear standoff, there could be new nuclear nations as a result of instability because they want to help themselves and feel secure. Even before you add those other nations, missile defense complicates what every other nation has to do, we already see that missile defense in South Korea is provocative to China, which is why China has been so aggressive in their response towards South Korea, because China understands that that will force China to change a little bit of how they manage their nuclear deterrence scheme with the United States. But it's not just about China and the United States. It's also about other nations that find themselves in a balance with China, such as India. And India may have to change how they balance against China due to China's advancements that are a result of THAAD. And that in turn means you might have Pakistan being forced to change what they do to catch up to India's advancements. And so we have this chain of events, and every step along the way increases the possibility of some sort of nuclear disaster, because you encourage every nation in the chain to become more dangerous. You encourage every nation in the chain to become more paranoid about the potential for other nations to implicate them in a nuclear showdown. And that's all before you add new nations to the mix, such as South Korea or Japan. So it's a big mess.
Huge mess. And unfortunately, we are the one, we don't have to deal with it, thank God, but we are definitely the ones who have to debate about it. And on top of that, I think that the big takeaway from the pod is, given how we and, you know, Matt and I have sprawled, you can sort of see how topic knowledge is going to be very important, but not topic knowledge, I want to say, so much as what you think your strategy is, knowing your strategy better than your opponent, because you just don't know where they're going to pull their strategy from. They could pull their strategy from India-Pakistan arms race, ROC-ROK arms race, Ukraine as the example for why North Korea, or rather South Korea, needs to arm itself with nuclear weapons, etc., etc. It just keeps going. Mm-hmm. You've seen how many things interconnect within this topic. And so I think that if you try to master all of it, you're going to drive yourself crazy. You're probably better off picking a couple strategies, going deep, and just knowing it better than your opponent.
This has been the RFD with Corey Ackerman and Matt Malia. We hope you found the chat informative and useful. We are interested in your questions or your comments. You can email them to us. The email address is contact@rfdcast.com, and we may feature some questions in future casts if they're good or they're topic related. If you've been listening to the cast on SoundCloud, you should also know that we have a website you can listen at. That's called rfdcast.com. We hope you stick around and share the cast with other people who might be interested. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.